Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to be talking with an extraordinarily thoughtful individual. We've had the privilege of talking with him just last week, but at the very end of our conversation, I discovered that his new book, entitled The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, which is an effort to sort of make sense of the globalists' agenda, has just come out. We've been talking about it in Prospect for some time with its author, Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, a man I've come to admire greatly since he first came across my radar scope as a refugee from Marxism, having been a professor imbued with it and teaching it at New York University for some time. He realized the error of his ways, praise the Lord, and has come over to the good guy's side, and we couldn't be more pleased at that, and most especially because what he brings with him, of course, is a deep understanding, not just of political science and history writ large, but specifically of the ideology that he once espoused and that we now confront increasingly here within our own country. Dr. Rechtenwald has written some 11 or 12 books now, I think, including, of course, the most recent one, The Great Reset, but also Thought Criminal, Beyond Woke, and The Google Archipelago, in which he talks about the digital gulag and the simulation of freedom. A very, very rich table to discuss a lot of things of great interest and great import. And we're delighted to have him back for a full hour to talk about all of this. Dr. Rechtenwald, again, welcome back to Securing America, sir. It's so good to have you with us once again.
Yes, thanks for having me, Frank. Great to be here.
I want to start by picking up on a topic that we discussed when you were with me last week, namely a bit of history on these great utopian initiatives. You did a very interesting piece at Mises.org in which you talked about the great leap backwards, not to be confused, of course, with how Mao branded it, namely the great leap forward. To help us set the stage for a conversation about today's utopian initiative, the Great Reset. Walk us quickly through that previous experience and why it's instructive for where we find ourselves today.
Yeah, that's a great question, Frank. And so, I mean, the Great Leap Forward, as Mao envisioned it, would be this great acceleration of production, agricultural output, and industrial output. What Mao tried to do with the peasantry was to basically he created communes. So there were communes of some of thousands or tens of thousands of villagers, and they had to give up all private property from the start, and they had no freedom of movement. They couldn't leave the commune, so they were effectively slaves right from the start. And then he introduced this industrial, so-called industrial process of steel making in the small blast furnaces in each person's like yard or porch. And the idea was to surpass the Great Britain in industrial output. And so it drew a lot of peasants off of the farms, especially the men. The men were mostly consigned to this metallurgy, and the women were left to farm, and then even food was communalized. There was, you didn't eat alone. You ate in these, or as a family, you ate in these vast cafeterias. And so it was this collectivization process, and so they, you know, expected to have this great leap in production. there was this idea that there would be this surge, and so that China would catch up with the industrial powers, like especially Great Britain. I don't know why they targeted that. I guess because it had been the first site of the Industrial Revolution. And so
let me just ask you, Michael, because I think this kind of makes the mind reel when you think about the huge steel manufacturing plants in this country. Now many of them sold for scrap metal themselves, but at the heyday of our production of steel, this was not the kind of thing you would do in little pits in people's backyards. Right. How exactly did that work out as an industrial leap forward?
Well, most of what they produced in these small blast furnaces turned out to be utterly useless. And so they were actually melting down everything you can find, everything they could find that was made of anything like metal, trying to make steel out of it. And it was a total disaster. It led to, a complete waste of resources, both manual labor in terms of raw material, so-called raw material, because they were actually, people would melt down their silverware and things like this. I mean, it was ludicrous. They fudged everything in terms of the output. The Chinese Communist Party basically made, doublespeak and lies about all of the production that was going on. And then agriculture was similarly decimated.
Part because the men were working on the steel and it was left to women to try to cope with the farming.
Right. This misappropriation of labor was enormous. Yeah. Yeah. And Mao had some crazy ideas about farming. Most of them developed from Lysenko in the Soviet Union. It was Lysenkoism, this notion that that the environment was all determining as far as biological life was concerned. And so, Lysenko believed you could turn barley into oat and things like this with the right conditions, and you could grow crops at any temperatures and things like this. And also Mao believed that seeds should be sown much closer together than hitherto, because he believed that they liked collectivization. The seeds themselves preferred to be in close company with other seeds. And this
you can't make this stuff up.
You can't make it up. This is just unbelievable. And so
the cumulative effect of all of this, as you pointed out in our last visit, was mass starvation.
Yeah.
As well as more general privation, right? And
terror.
And at the end of the day, it required, as I understand it, sort of the use of brute force with the Red Guards to bring Mao back to power after this debacle. Have I got the history of that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Talk a little bit about that, because it also, I think, sets the predicate for our further conversation about how the next utopian nightmare is likely to be foisted.
Yeah, so Mao had basically had to retreat after this because of the debacle was so enormous and the famine was so great. I mean, the estimates are 20 to 43 million people died of hunger. And then there was also terror. Basically, they terrorized and killed and did horrible things. Even cannibalism was becoming rampant. The eating of children, just god awful.
Just in order to survive, this in was order required. To survive.
Same thing happened in the Soviet Union. This is very little known, that there was widespread cannibalism after the revolution.
Right? Hold the thought, sir. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald on the nightmares of utopian pasts and future, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson had an unsettling welcome to the new year. In an interview published on January 1st by Politico, the former U.S. senator announced that the Chinese Communist Party is preparing to colonize the moon and may use force to deny us access to it. This is not exactly news, as experts like Richard Fisher have been warning for years that the CCP is intent on dominating what it calls the Earth-Moon system as part of Beijing's bid to control our planet. But U.S. policymakers, and particularly those involved with America's space programs, have for decades encouraged the public to believe leftist nostrums about the high frontier being a pristine international commons reserved for peaceful exploration and scientific research. We're now in a real and potentially deadly space race with the Chinese. It's one we literally can't afford to lose. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are spending this hour with a fascinating man, a very learned academic. Indeed, he was a professor at the New York University for quite some time, teaching political science and the like to undergraduates and graduate students. He has had a change of life, I think it's fair to say, as a result of a falling out with his former comrades, literally, in the Marxist academia. And he is now a free man, we're very pleased to say, and a prodigiously creative and productive force for good, explaining to us both dangers of the past arising from Marxist and other utopian impulses, and the present danger, in fact, something called the Great Reset, which is the subject and the title, in fact, of his new book, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty. Dr. Rechtenwald, again, thank you for your time. You've set the predicate for us by describing how Mao essentially broke the Chinese people with his Great Leap Forward, as he called it. We might just quickly touch on the horror that followed it when he sought to return to power through the use of brute force. Tell us a little bit about the Red Guards, because, well, I think it's instructive in terms of what you yourself experienced not so long ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for Mao's resurgence, I mean, Mao's resurgence depended upon these Red Guards, which were very young people who were basically, consigned to terrorize the population and the leadership in the party. So there was a great purging inside the party. Mao accused everybody of having capitalist ideological predispositions. The failures of the system were blamed on the so-called bourgeoisie, or even the bourgeois ideas of people. So even though the country was now communist, he claimed that there was still a bourgeois ideology that had persisted in the population and it had to be purged out of them.
Yeah. This is the class warfare, basically, at the core of Marxist.
Yeah, except that there was no real capitalist class in existence at this point, because they had already been, wiped out, and whatever capitalism or private property had existed was already appropriated by the state. And so there was nothing to attack except people's ideas. He assumed that the reason why the communist revolution hadn't led to the utopia promised was that people were recalcitrant in their ideology, and they still held on to capitalist ideology or bourgeois ideology.
Right. So this begat the Cultural Revolution and the struggle sessions and the kangaroo courts, I guess you might call them, that essentially affected those purges. And it brings me to your own situation. Just a brief word on the struggle sessions you were put through. when you dared to question the ideology of the Marxist at New York University.
Yeah, I mean, I made what I thought were rational and quite reasonable criticisms of the social justice left and the way they were running rampant and the kinds of things they were doing, like shutting down speakers and opening up safe spaces to protect people from speech they couldn't endure. And the more alarming aspect was the institutionalization of all this social justice ideology through the establishment of a bias reporting hotline, which allowed students to report on their professors for deviant thoughts, for bias, infractions, and microaggressions. I thought this was very Stasi-like, and I spoke up about it. It created a
Stasi or Stalinist, as the Stalinist case may be. Yeah. It goes all over the totalitarian left, and to the extent that this has informed your thinking about not only the nature of the ideological struggle in the United States at the moment, but also the Great Reset as a sort of new age great leap forward.
Indeed.
Talk about this transition as you see it, how you've met it and how we should be thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, we should think about this Great Reset in terms of this Great Leap Forward or Great Leap Backward, because it's similarly an effort to destroy private property, to infringe upon corporations and capitalist production, and to rationalize this production in a new way. And so they're imposing similar ideological nonsense on everything. Similarly, destroying economies, destroying industries, attacking the fossil fuel industry, for example, very utopian, because they imagine that we can transition from fossil fuels to renewables without a tremendous devastation of the public good and the economy. It's similarly a leap. Like the Great Leap Forward or Backward, it's a leap. It's this idea that this can be done through sheer will, and there's no rational basis for it. And there's the ideological element as well, which is similar to the Cultural Revolution. That is to say, we have this new woke ideology, which I believe has a very similar function to the communist ideology of Mao. And that is, it is about shaming people out of believing in their right, their rights and their property, making them feel that all they have gotten has been by virtue of privilege, and likewise they're undeserving, and they should abdicate their property and their rights for the greater good. And the World Economic Forum uses this language, the greater good, the common good, our common destiny. You know, whenever we see these kinds of phrases used by these totalitarian types, we should be very, very alarmed, because this is the exact language that was marshaled by the Soviets and the Chinese Communist Party.
Michael Rechtin, well, we're going to have to take a break here in a moment, but I just wanted to sort of tee up the next part of this conversation about your new book, The Global Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda, by inviting you to talk a little bit about how these globalists, Klaus Schwab sort of being now, I guess, their iconic leader out of the World Economic Forum in Davos and so on, actually harkens back to and embraces even today the sort of Maoist thought, or Xi Jinping thought, as the case may be, his successor Mao's, who aspires actually to supplant him in the pantheon of great communist Chinese leaders. This is a a piece of the story that I don't think we fully appreciate, and whether it's that these globalists, at their heart of hearts, are totalitarians, Marxist or otherwise, or whether they simply admire them greatly, is a topic that I want to discuss with you. On the other side of this very short break, we'll be right back with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, the author of Thought Criminal, Beyond Woke, and most recently, The Great Reset, available now at your favorite bookstores and outlets. We'll be right back with more right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with the author, most recently, of The Great Reset, The Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. And Michael, I think this is so important because, as they say, you can't tell the players without a playbook. Talk to us about whether there's simply an envious admiration on the part of Klaus Schwab and his ilk, masters of the universe, the capitalist elite, the global new order types, of Xi Jinping personally and his program, his system, or whether there's actually more of a affinity and embrace of Marxism itself?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very big question that I tackle in the book and treat in quite a bit of depth. So there's no question that the World Economic Forum Schwab, Klaus Schwab, has a great deal of admiration for the Chinese system. He's invited Xi to speak on numerous occasions, and he will have a number of representatives at the upcoming meeting starting on this week, as a matter of fact, the 53rd annual meeting. And there has been a great deal of admiration for Marxism in general. I mean, Schwab has a picture of Lenin in his office. There's a great deal of admiration for the Chinese system as it exists today. Maurice Strong, who was one of a major environmentalists, of course, the first head of the UN environmental program, and one of Schwab's major mentors, said point blank that the Chinese have it right. They are using capitalist production for socialist ends. And this really epitomizes what the Great Reset is attempting to do. It wants to use capitalism for socialist ends.
Which would be collectivism at its core.
Yes.
So you're saying that the World Economic Forum, Davos, globalist elite is good with collectivism. In spite of, among other things, some very bad previous experience with it, notably the one you've talked about at the outset of the show, the Great Leap Forward.
As a matter of fact, I did a search for the word collective in Klaus Schwab's book, COVID-19, The Great Reset, and there were like 50-some uses of the word collective and collective good and our collective interest, collective destiny, our collective everything. I mean, he just used this. He's a collectivist through and through. And everything is always about.
And I guess a synonym for that is the common good and
common
and,
good,
the light, right?
And the greater good, and all these phrases, which are sure telltale signs of a totalitarian mindset.
Impulse.
Why? Because they force everybody into the same program, by force, in effect.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I wanted to get to next is how I think it was Margaret Thatcher who talked about, you know, the problem with socialism is not only that eventually you run out of other people's money, but that you can only bring about its practice by force.
Right.
At the end of the day, people are not going to gravitate to collectivism, the personal property, private property, you know, the return on your own hard work are, I think, instinctive for the vast majority of us. So it brings to the fore, and if it is now really implicit, at least in the Great Reset of this globalist elite, that they countenance, if not intend, to use coercive techniques to accomplish their end state, then that's, as they say, a horse of a different color, isn't it, than just people who, you know, want a better world.
Yes. I mean, Schwab wrote in that book, COVID-19, The Great Reset, with Thierry Malheret, he wrote, you know, if acute crises have taught us anything, is that big government has always been necessary to ameliorate these crises. COVID is no different. So basically, he's talking about massive statism here and control and intervene in the economic system. We're looking at the difference between two vastly distinct worldviews. The worldview, on the one hand, that individuals have their own interests, they pursue their own interests, and it ends up benefiting the whole because they bring their talents to the marketplace, they do what they want, and they're allowed to produce
and what they're good at,
and they bring this creates wealth for various reasons. That property has to be in private hands for wealth production, and the other worldview is that that the collective comes first, and it must be deemed all important, and that the only kind of efforts that are worthwhile are those that so supposedly benefit the collective, and one should sacrifice for this collective. One should give up one's own interests for this collective. And this is
is the operative word.
Yeah, and in the case of this Great Reset agenda, they have very surreptitious ways about wresting your property and your rights from you. It isn't at the point of a gun, quite frankly, but it is a very, very surreptitious way of getting property off of people, not only through increased taxes, which they advocate, but through the stakeholder capitalism regime. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that and how it is kind of a stalking horse for a coercive sort of imposition of this program. Stakeholder capitalism, of course, is not to be confused with shareholder capitalism, which is really, you know, the foundation of free market capitalism, is it not?
Right. I mean, shareholder capitalism is that basically a corporation, as Milton Friedman put it, its primary responsibility is to produce profit for its shareholders. Stakeholder capitalism, I mean, Milton Friedman and Ludwig von Mises, these are the arch enemies of Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum. I mean, he's denounced them repeatedly, especially Milton Friedman. The idea of stakeholder capitalism is that supposedly corporations and production, anybody really should be benefiting all these stakeholders and not necessarily or nearly exclusively the shareholders. And in order to do this, they have created this stakeholder capitalism regime, which is using, frankly, the mechanism is the ESG score, primarily the environmental, social, and governance score, which has infiltrated corporations now and forced them to account for their environmental, social, and governance behavior. And this really makes the control of companies coming from a centralized standpoint, it's not exactly a state body, it's an extra governmental body that's now telling these people what to do. And it's forcing them to change their behavior, not to benefit their shareholders, but to benefit society and the collective good and all this. So
one of the premier architects of this whole agenda, as you know, very much, I think, of a piece with Klaus Schwab and the larger World Economic Forum community, is Larry Fink of BlackRock,
yes,
who has been weaponizing his firm's vast holdings in most Fortune 500 companies, if not all of them, essentially to compel them to improve their so-called ESG, environment and social governance scores. And we're seeing this apply to countries as well now, and to starve entities, companies, governments that aren't going along with this program of investment capital. All of this is, again, coercive, not with guns, but using these other means to compel certain behavior, no?
Yes, it amounts to force in the sense that it's using a massive power block in order to, you know, coerce companies into abiding by their dictates. And Larry Fink, BlackRock Inc., is one of the, if Klaus Schwab is the ideologue of all this, I would like to put it like this. Klaus Schwab is to Larry Fink as Marx was to Lenin. Marx had all the ideas and Lenin put them into practice. Similarly, Schwab has the ideas and Larry Fink is putting them into practice. And he has control through BlackRock of $10 trillion worth of assets. And along with the other majors like Vanguard Group and State Street and UBS, they're controlling $22 trillion. And Larry Fink said explicitly in his letter to CEOs in 2021, stakeholder capitalism is capitalism. This is not a woke agenda, he said, which tells you that it is. This is capitalism. And he said it clearly, it's a threat. If you don't abide by this ESG, you will not get money. You will not get our capital investments.
And not only is he saying it,
he's doing
making it.
It
stick.
Yeah.
We have to take another short break. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Michael Reckenwald on where this global reset would take America if allowed to run its full course. We'll be back with that and much more right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We're continuing this hour-long, very special, hugely important conversation with the author of a brand new book entitled The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. And to make this unraveling even more, well, pertinent and personal, I want to ask you, Michael Rechtenwald, drawing not only on the study that went into this book, but of course, some of those previous works, and of course, your own personal experience, Thought Criminal and Beyond Woke and the digital gulags, as you call it, Google Archipelago. What does this mean for America if the great resetters have their way for our freedoms, for our institutions, for our form of government, our economy, of course, as well?
Yes, I mean, it would mean basically what we're talking about is the UN, which is a partner with the WEF, you know, they formed a partnership in 2019 to bring about the Sustainable Development Goals of Agenda 2030. I mean, in some sense, you can think of the Great Reset as that, as a public-private partnership element of accelerating the Agenda 2030 goals. So what we're going to see here, and we're already seeing it with the Biden administration, we saw at least 12 executive orders aimed at attacking the fossil fuel industry. We saw with the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, the largest requisition of monies towards climate change mitigation, supposedly $287 billion in history. We're seeing the effects of it on our gas pumps. We're seeing it, the effects of it in our heating bills and our electricity bills. And they make no bones. And it's a great leap. They're trying to leap from fossil fuels to this renewables. And it's already impinging terribly on the American public. And it'll get worse if this continues. And we're seeing it.
And in part, if I could just interrupt you, we know that so because we're seeing how countries that are further down these tubes, Sri Lanka comes to mind as an example,
right.
Some of the European countries as well. We're just not quite as far along as they are, but that's the trajectory.
That's the
to which
trajectory.
They would condemn
the trajectory
us, right?
is towards, yes, it's towards the Sri Lanka scenario or the Netherlands, where farmers are actually having their farms bought up by force by the state because they can't abide by the ESG practices that are being foisted on them. And the food hub initiative that is centered in the Netherlands is actually a World Economic Forum initiative. So this is being foisted on them. They're being forced to curtail their nitrous oxide emissions to an extent that has will make farming unprofitable. And so there are people losing their farms as we speak. And so this industrial...
Tell me a little bit more about this food hub initiative. I don't know that I've heard of that, other than that the Netherlands is apparently a huge exporter of food at the moment. Or has
they're
been,
the second largest exporter of food in the world. And they're also the...
tiny country.
And this gave... I think Schwab would have put this food hub initiative in the United States if he could, but he knows that it wouldn't fly over here without immense pushback. So he's put it in this European country, the Netherlands. And what it is it's an initiative to spread this great reset, the great agricultural reset around the world. It's a hub. It's a model for what they want to do everywhere. And so it is the initiative to meet the EU's objectives of reducing carbon emissions by 50% by 2050. And
that means not just reducing the amount of fuel that's consumed, presumably in your tractors and so on, but fertilizer as
fertilizer,
well.
Fertilizer, the nitrates in your fertilizer, and the nitrous and the ammonia that comes from cattle, and even the methane coming from the cattle's burping. They're even talking about putting masks on cattle. And this is, I'm not making this up. So this grand...
This sounds positively Maoist, I have to say.
Oh, it's totally Maoist. It's yeah. It's this grand project to spread this reset agriculturally, which would, for the United States, it will maybe lead to, if we import this food initiative, food hub initiative here, and it's going to come probably through executive orders, if it does, under Biden, we're going to see the same kind of detriments to our agriculture. And we are the largest exporter of food, and we will see real problems, and we'll see prices skyrocket. But really, if these people are humanitarians, then they're really not paying attention, because it has been predicted under Trump. It was predicted by, I forget which agency, that this could cause worldwide famine if implemented globally.
Well, that's where I was going to go next, is food insecurity is a nice way of describing what could actually be privation and starvation on an epic scale. And yeah, we're starting to see that in places around the world. It's not just lines for food are reminiscent of, you know, the communist bad old days. But sometimes there's just not the food to be had, and there will be increasingly less and less of it as nitrates and other fertilizers become unavailable and collectivism, you know, spreads in the agricultural sector. You know, this brings me to another aspect of the globalist agenda that's not much remarked upon, but I think you talk about in the book. We're going to have to take a final break here in just a moment, but I wanted to tee this up by sort of a segue from starving people to death to other assaults on the family and the whole transgenderist movement, to undermine essentially the population and mm-hmm. its renewal as we need it to be, especially to support those of us of a certain age who That's are right. in need of that social safety net, if you will. All of that is forthcoming from the author of The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, a man who knows whereof he speaks when it comes to Marxism because he used to practice it. We'll be right back with him right after this. Well, Welcome back to our final installment of this remarkable tour d'horizon, as they say in France, of the threat, and I use that term advisedly, that we face from these, globalists of various stripes. And I think at the end of the day, we should be clear, whether you're a Marxist totalitarian, whether you're an Islamist totalitarian, whether you're a so-called capitalist, a collectivist totalitarian, the bottom line is always you have an end state that is antithetical to everything we hold dear in this country. And indeed, we, the United States of America, its people, are antithetical to their agenda, and therefore we must be destroyed. And Michael Rechtenwald, we were talking a little bit about depopulation as another facet of this agenda of the totalitarian left. Just walk us through how that fits into all of this, the famine, the energy privation, what have you.
Yes. I mean, one of the ways to understand this, really the only way to understand it, is to understand that the World Economic Forum wasn't born ab nihilo. It was a descendant of these other globalist organizations that came before it, like the Club of Rome, for example. And the Club of Rome has been pushing population ethics, as they call it, for decades. And they have, they wrote the book Beyond the Limits and Limits to Growth and all of these tracks that decried the population bomb, as Paul Ehrlich put it. And they have aimed at, in conjunction with the UN, who has had population conferences dating all the way back to the 60s, and I think even before, and they have been advocating population control, including sterilization and abortion. Where Paul Ehrlich is concerned, and he has connections to the World Economic Forum, putting sterilants and in the water supply and in food. So they think that the human race, the majority of us, represent a scourge on the planet. So they need to get rid of us and get rid of our numbers. And the UN's Agenda 2030 adopts the population principles of the final conference, the ultimate conference that is the last one held of the UN. And the WEF is a partner with the UN, and its main purpose in that partnership is to bring about Agenda 2030 Sustainable Development Goals.
We don't happen to be part of a sustainable agenda.
We're not sustainable.
A threat to it. That's right.
They've been aiming
that's the bottom line. We're not sustainable.
That's exactly. They think that especially the United States is unsustainable in our consumption and in our population. So they've been aiming at this for decades. The UN, they've been aiming at our consumption. They have blatantly said that a person born in the U.S. consumes more than anybody else. So they need to get rid of those people.
Right. And the system that enables their behavior.
Yes.
We're almost out of time, Michael. I did want to touch quickly on two things. One is how a central bank digital currency can facilitate this radical agenda and certainly the transformation of our country beyond recognition, point one. And very quickly, what we might be able to do about all of these things to prevent them from coming to pass.
Yeah, I mean, the CBDC, the central bank digital currency, is, of course, would be currency held by the central bank like the Fed. You would have a bank account with them in this digital currency, and this would allow them to have surveillance over spending, savings, and debt. All of your transaction would be known to the state and could be monitored and could be prevented in some cases, and it could be tied to a social credit score. And so, likewise, it could limit the kinds of consumption and production you could do and who you could sell to, who you're allowed to buy from. And they could use the ESG, personalize it to each person, and make it impossible to undergo certain activity and behavior like driving or whatever.
And this is not a hypothetical kind of arrangement. We're actually watching a place that has the social credit system in
in China, and they have rolled out Yes, they've rolled out the CBDC there as well. They're in the pilot stage. Yeah.
So quickly, we've got 2 minutes. What do you counsel we do beyond recognizing the kind of threats that you're talking about in the Great Reset?
Well, there's a 9-point plan at the end of the book, and it lays out the specifics, but basically I call it the grand refusal. And really, it doesn't amount to some revolution. It's a counter-revolution because these people are revolutionaries. This is a counter-revolution. It's basically, they are puppet masters. Okay, all we need to do is cut the strings from the puppet masters and they can't control us. So we have to refuse all of their technologies that are connected with this transhuman agenda and the control of the population, like CBDCs, digital identity, social credit scores, carbon footprint tracking, et cetera, et cetera. We have to divest from the ESG indexed companies and banks, if you can. That's very difficult, but it still can be done. We can't feed this beast of control. We need to practice the free market in our own lives. That is to say, keep alive production and be as entrepreneurial as you possibly can. Don't have dependence on these companies and institutions.
Don't try to build a blast furnace in your backyard. But yeah, there are other things that you can do assure your survival in an environment like this. But cutting the strings of the puppet masters, I think, is a brilliant metaphor for what we need to do in the counter-revolution. Michael Rechtenwald, you are an inspiration as a counter-revolutionary freedom fighter in your own right, as well as a man who's got some great ideas about the nature of the problem, what we have to do about it. You alluded in passing to something that we're going to have you back on soon to visit about as well, and that is transhumanism and how that plays into all of the other things we've discussed here. But for today, let me just say thank you. Congratulations on the publication at last of this terrific book, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. I commend it to all of our listeners. I hope you'll look forward, as I do, to Michael Rechtenwald's next visit. But in the meantime, go to school on the Great Reset. Thank you for listening. Join us again for the next edition of Securing America, and go forth and multiply.